This is the Liminalista Podcast Between. This is Jason Horsley, and this is the second in a series of cross-temporal interspatial dialogues with the late Rudolf Steiner, courtesy of the readings of Dale Brunsbold. What you expect? To set the scene, it's the 21st of January, 2021. That's 01-21-21. I'm in Galicia, Spain, in the middle of nowhere, in a house on a hill, with my cat on the bed and my sister down the corridor, and trying to find firewood for the stove, keep us warm for the next few weeks, where there is central heating here as well. And returning to Steiner, I've found the feedback to be encouraging and a number of confirmations from various different corners, listeners who have been interested in Steiner and even listening to the audios that I've been sharing for some time before now without my knowledge, others who I might have expected some skepticism but seem to be intrigued, and so on. So overall, my sense with Steiner is that this is a fruitful avenue of inquiry and exploration, although at the same time I'm aware that there are going to be traps and snares and pitfalls, and I may at the end of this exploration almost certainly will come away with a very different viewpoint. Currently I'm feeling quite inspired and optimistic about old Rudy, the sense that he might actually really be one of the good guys, even though we've heard of him and he's had major influence in the world. Not least of the reasons for thinking that, it's the fact that his name has been besmirched recently with the R word for his theories about race, which I have yet to come upon. So the fact that he has been tarred and feathered by the ideological police does suggest that there might be some good there. I'll obviously require more than that. And obviously there is a lot more than that, which is the audios themselves. I've been continuing to listen during the night and sleep through most of what I've been hearing. The clips that I'm going to share today are ones that I culled a couple of weeks ago when I first began this exploration. I'm hoping that I'll just have some organic responses now when I listen back to them. One thing that's occurred to me in the last few days is the irony of how once upon a time when I was Jake, back in 2007 when I first met Dave, as shared those impressions on a recent podcast, I said to Dave maybe he could try to get through a whole presentation without once using the word spiritual. And then I commented to myself that for me any sentence with the word spiritual loses coherency or lacks coherence, because the word seems just like a placekeeper to me, back then anyway, and it didn't really have any specific meaning. Dave had counted, as I recounted, that he did use it as a placekeeper to some extent, but as a juxtaposition with the material and the spiritual. And my response had been, well, that's part of the problem, that it reinforces a dualistic perspective. Anyway, I say it's ironic now because old Rudy, with his spiritual science, uses the word, or used the word spiritual, as Dale pronounces it, countless times, practically every other sentence, I would say. So if I was still adhering to that position I had back in 2007, I couldn't make head or tail of Rudy, and I would just have given up in disdain. However, clearly that's not the case, and to a certain extent, and this would be the context of spiritual science, Steiner's lectures really are all about what the word spiritual means. And so it's more than a place keeper, it's the context. Like, everything he's talking about is the spiritually scientific perspective, and what spiritual is, what spirits are, what the spiritual dimensions consist of, and so on, in a scientific manner. And I am reevaluating, of course, for that reason. I still am not convinced that the word is entirely necessary, or at least as frequently as he uses it. And I have noticed, I'm not sure if there'll be in the audience that we hear today, but that he's also used the word elemental beings. And I think that that's not necessarily a better term, but a necessary term as well as spiritual, because in my sense, spiritual would relate to pure spirit, formlessness, and eternal essence, if it's going to have any very precise meaning, as opposed to just the general meaning of that which is not obviously material, that which is not solid or tangible. And then the interim, or the area in between, on the one hand would be the psychic realms, on the other hand, I think the elemental, because there are certainly elemental forces that are not material in any coarse sense, even though they are observable materially. Electricity, for example. Now, obviously wind and fire and so on, and even things like mist. I mean, there's a spectrum there between the material and the ephemeral, and then finally at this other end, which is the spiritual. All right, well, that's the preamble. Now I'm going to play an isolated clip about dreams, which really got my attention.
Dreaming corresponds to what goes on in our waking life, when we make great efforts to remember. But if, during sleep, we exert ourselves only slightly, this corresponds to the ordinary process of remembering during the day, when we make no efforts, because the remembrances come of themselves. After death, the remembrances we have of the waking life now ended are soon over. Then, in the period of Kamaloka, man lives through all the experiences of the nights in backward order. In our life here on earth, we are occupied with what the days brought to us, and also, although without being aware of it, with what we experienced during the nights. After death, however, everything we lived through during the nights comes into our consciousness. Night by night, everything comes back to us. And it is important to realize that to begin with, the dead lives through his nights. This is by no means easy to realize and can only gradually be discovered. Naturally, a man lives through his life, but he lives through it by way of his experiences during the nights. I have often said that the time spent in Kamaloka is approximately one-third of the lifetime on earth. If you reflect that a man who does not die in childhood spends about a third of his life asleep, you will understand why the time in Kamaloka amounts approximately to a third of the time of the earthly life. The Kamaloka period lasts for as long as the time spent in sleep, about one-third of the whole lifetime on earth. It is very necessary to gather together carefully the items of concrete knowledge that have been given, and to correlate them. And that is why, it has such a jarring effect, although that does not quite express what I mean, when one who is trying to speak about the spiritual world with full responsibility is asked all kinds of questions about this or that point after the lectures. These people want to know everything, But on the other hand, one has been endeavoring to speak only of what has actually been thought through to the end. One is forced then to speak about a whole number of matters into which there has not yet been opportunity for thorough investigation.
The dead lives through his nights. Now, why did I include that? Well, two reasons. The first is that my own experience of waking from dreams is such consistently that of having lost access to a very rich vein of perception, experience and awareness. So there's always a sense, well, there's almost always a sense on waking when I can't remember my dreams, which is generally the case, or didn't used to be the case, of having lost access to something precious. And the corresponding feeling that can border on despair. And I've been aware that this corresponds with the need, the felt need to have access to the contents of my unconscious because of what is there that would provide solutions in the present. And also the pressure of the unconscious, both to become conscious from one side of it, and the pressure of the conscious mind to keep it unconscious. There's this kind of tension there between the two things that potentially is just the way it needs to be, and that there are many things that we work out at an unconscious level that we wouldn't be able to handle in a conscious state of ordinary awareness, which is precisely why they were pushed into the unconscious. But they can be resolved there. And as far as recalling what was resolved, that's secondary. I'll sleep on it as an expression. We may come up with the solution the next morning, but not remember the process by which we arrived at it. That's the process of dreaming. And yeah. There is nonetheless, for me, a continued sense of another life being lived that I desperately want to regain access to. So the idea that when we die, and it's the first time I've heard this idea, when we die we relive or re-experience or review all of our dreaming experiences in the night, in consecutive order or otherwise, who knows, is fascinating to me and very enticing, and I think if anything would cause me to look forward to dying in a healthy way rather than a suicidal way, it would be this. I've long since suspected or believed that we review our life when we die. Steiner seems to be saying no, all that stuff you remember when you're alive and awake, and so that you quickly forget when you die. I wonder what he would say about childhood and lost or suppressed memories. Seems to me, my sense is that those would be the first things to come back when we die. But Steiner's view is somewhat consistent with that, because dreams are by definition generally suppressed memories, things that are stored in the unconscious. The other thing that occurred to me, which is perhaps very obvious, is that this very literal framework for what occurs when we die, that we relive that third of our life during which we were asleep and unconscious, and what happened there perceptually, is pretty consistent with the idea that when we die we must face the contents of our unconscious. It's a literalization of it. And certainly, as enticing as dreams are to me, precisely because they seem more intense and rich in meaning, and also to be occurring at deeper or higher levels of awareness than I normally experience, by the same token, the deepest forms of despair and horror I know that I've experienced while I'm asleep. So I suspect that disowned, suppressed, or forgotten childhood trauma, never mind past life stuff, is often accessed by us in our dreams. We often revisit it one way or another while we're asleep and dreaming. So to recall our dreams would also be to recall, re-enter into those lost realms of childhood and other pre-verbal, pre-cognitive states of being. And now we need to talk about Lucifer.
So we see the human being between birth and death as he relates to the forward-moving spiritual powers. And in a sense, he is between Lucifer and Ahriman. In order that the whole development of the human being may proceed in the right way, this relationship must remain like this also, between death and rebirth. Except that the things which are in us between birth and death will be outside between death and rebirth. Inwardly, Lucifer has his claws in the human being from the moment to which our memory goes back. Inwardly so, for human beings know nothing of this, unless they learn something of it from spiritual science and get to feel about it.
Well, that seems like a key point to interject at, because he said that Lucifer has his claws in us from the moment our memories begin. And of course that varies for a number of people, for all people. And in my case, my memories don't really begin until very late in life, around 6 or 7. And one of the things I was told by Liz, a former partner and ally, was that I was in the care of the angels until the age of 7, which might also relate to Lucifer not being able to get his claws into me, perhaps.
Things are different after death. Lucifer makes his appearance at a particular time, just as surely as he does inwardly between birth and death, and now outwardly in the life between death and rebirth. He stands before us in his whole form there, is at our side, and we walk with him. We know little of Lucifer before we have gone to the gate of death, but we know him clearly and definitely when he is at our side between death and rebirth. It is only that awareness of this can be rather unpleasant in the present time cycle.
Oh, Rudy has the gift of understatement.
We may thus go through the region between death and rebirth, having Lucifer at our side. There's not only something terrible about him, but also something beautiful, glorious as far as his outer form goes, and realize that he is needed by the world. A time is coming more and more where people will only be able to go through life after death with Lucifer if they have already got to intuit and know the Luciferic impulses in the human soul properly whilst here in life. People, and there will also be more and more of them as time goes on, who do not want to know about Lucifer, and they are probably in the majority, will know all the more of Lucifer after death. It is not only that he will be at their side, but being at their side, he will be drawing on their powers of soul all the time. He will vampirize human beings. This is what people prepare for by not knowing, to be vampirized by Lucifer. With this, one deprives oneself of powers for the next life, for one will be giving them over to Lucifer in a way.
All right. Well, those who followed my output will know why that means so much to me. Probably hard to find a more concise and affecting validation of my path in life that I have become so intimately familiar with Lucifer on the inside, on the inside of my psyche, if I have. Of course, I've had to kind of quarantine some of that experience and knowledge, postpone or dial back on my certainty around it, for a number of reasons that you may also be familiar with, some relating to my brother and his path, others to the awareness of how ideas and beliefs are incepted in us through cultural artifacts and manipulations, and the main one being the element of trauma in generating crucial fictions. However, these things are rarely either or, and as with the alien abduction narrative that I unpacked, took apart rather in Prisoner of Infinity, which we'll be getting to anon in relation to Lucifer, I remain on the fence about my Lucifer experiences, and truth be told, to a certain degree I've taken a position for the good of all, including myself, of what I consider to be a more responsible approach by diagnosing those perceptions in that key period in my life of being the one and Lucifer possession as delusional and as trauma generated. But I have to be honest here, I never essentially believed that wholly. I was acknowledging that element, but never to the extent that I rejected my felt sense that I was connecting to a real presence and intelligence that transcended my own life and this world as we know it, an eternal being, let's say, a god. So, as I've already said in the first in this series, I'm aware that revisiting with new eyes a minefield that I never fully cleared because I still want to get to the other side of it, while not entirely sure that what's on the other side is worth getting to, is a risky endeavor. If nothing else, I can discover the rest of the minefields. Presumably there's a reason to remove minefields from one's psyche, regardless of where one's trying to get to. Really, I'm just trying to get to wholeness. And Rudy's model of the unholy trinity, let's say, or at least the unorthodox trinity of Ahriman, Lucifer and Christ, is very much about wholeness, about recognizing, tracking, mapping and integrating, harmonizing these different forces, not just within human history, an evolution of consciousness out there, the large thing, but specifically or most pertinently within our own souls. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying thanks, Rudy. You have really made me feel that I'm entering my house justified now, having done the shit work of a lifetime sympathy for the devil, getting down and dirty with Lucifer, and really getting to know the nature of that beast in a way that has been empowering and liberating, but not in the ways that I thought or anticipated. Because Lucifer is a very different animal in the Steiner interpretive model than certainly Crowley, and certainly Christianity, goes without saying. Any other model that I'm familiar with, including my own, although I would say it comes closest to my own being my own whole cloth invention. Well, not whole cloth, that's not true. I just reneged on my own self-debunking there. It wasn't whole cloth, but there was a large portion of that tapestry that was my own invention, in quotes, my own intuitive sensorial impression that admittedly I used these dodgy narratives to reinforce and bring out the colours and the forms. And now I recount of that, but it's interesting to me that Steiner's, which I didn't rely on very much at all, does seem to be the closest to my own intuitive felt sense about what Lucifer represents and why it's essential to get very closely acquainted with him.
Things are very much the same with regard to Ahriman. Here the situation is this. The two spirits are always present between death and rebirth. But on the one occasion, one of them is more present and the other less. On the other occasion, it is the other way round. We pass away and then return again in the life between death and rebirth. Lucifer is above all at our side in the passing away. Ahriman, when we move toward being born again. For Ahriman takes us back to the earth again. He is important in the second half of coming back again. And he, too, is able to do dreadful things, as it were, to the people who do not want to believe in him in their life between birth and death. He will give them too much of his powers. He confers on them something he has always to spare, the powers connected with earthly gravity that mean sickness and premature death for people, bringing all kinds of accidents that seem random into earthly existence, and so on. All this has to do with these Ahrimanic powers. In Munich, I presented the subject from a slightly different point of view. There, I showed that after death, the human soul can be the spirit who serves the powers that send sickness and death from the supersensible worlds to the sense-perceptible world. The element which makes life weak is most welcome to Ahriman, making it possible for him to weaken our lives further. But, again, we must not be biased in our judgment. It would be quite wrong to say, so it is very bad that Ahriman has taken us into life and that we may have to suffer the after-effects of him in life. No, it is good, because it may well be that a sickness turns out to be something that contributes a great deal to our ascending development.
All right, just to recap that, what Steiner is saying there is that Lucifer awaits us when we die, although he's there within us while we live, and to the extent that we haven't acknowledged or recognized and integrated his influences while we're alive, then we've got to pay the Reaper when we die, as in have a full-on encounter with Lucifer as the other, with no sense of the intimacy and of even of the benevolence potentially of that presence of just So that's that. Then Ahriman, on the other hand, is waiting on the other side of the afterlife, as in when we're nearing a rebirth, a reincarnation of our essence, whatever that is, whatever part of it of us it is that reincarnates. And again, to the extent that we have not acknowledged Ahriman in our life, in our conscious life, ditto, we are then ill-equipped to have a dialogue with Ahriman as we are nearing the rebirth, as in we are readying to rematerialize. And the result of that is not the horror on within the afterlife, but rather a series of circumstances or experiences in our incarnate life whereby Ahriman's influence is largely negative. We're given, as it were, a series of lessons where we're given the opportunity once again to recognize Ahriman's influence. The way Steiner describes it is more external than internal, although he did mention disease as well, which obviously is an internal thing, although one of our problems with disease, I'm thinking of my mother now, is that we don't very easily acknowledge that we've generated it internally. We still tend to see it as something that's invaded us. So there's a disowning even there. But anyway, in terms of random accidents, horrible events, decaying, degenerative diseases, and an encroaching sense of despair, this would be Ahriman's influence upon us in our lives, directly corresponding to the degree to which we failed to acknowledge Ahriman in the previous materialized life, and thereby to dialogue with him and perhaps collaborate with him during our rematerialization phase, where we're preparing once again to slide down the chute and back into the land of matter.
Approach the threshold that separates the supersensible from the sense perceptible world. We must always be prepared to modify our views a little and not judge things the way we are used to judging them in the ordinary physical world. For, I think you'll agree, the physical world has a superabundance of Maya. Where does the materialism in the physical world come from? That materialism where people say there is no Ahriman, there simply is no devil. Who is it who shouts loudest that there is no devil? Those who are most possessed by him.
CF page 432 of 16 Maps of Hell. In both cases, their nihilism and materialism, their lack of belief or respect for occult forces, made them the perfect tools for those forces to wield. They were ripe for possession.
For the spirit whom we call Ahriman is enormously interested in having his existence denied by those who are most possessed by him. Quote, "The common people never know the devil, even when they've caught him." Close quote. So that is a dreadful Maya, not to believe in Ahriman. For it means that he's collared one most of all when one does not believe in him. In that case, one gives him the greatest power over oneself. If it is wrong, therefore, to say that monists fight the devil when they rant and rave against him. No, a materialistic and monistic gathering where people rant and rave against the devil is liable to conjure up the devil. More than the witches of old do modern materialists call up the devil, much, much more so. That is the truth, and the other is Maya.
CERN comes to mind.
So we must learn to judge things differently. Someone who goes to a monistic meeting with materialistic nuance is untruthful when he says that these people free humanity from the devil. He ought to say, I am now going to a meeting where the devil is called into human culture with all the powers that human beings have. We should really be aware that as we grow into spiritual life, as it were, we learn not only concepts and ideas, but to rethink, refeel, and still be sensible enough when facing the outside world that we do not all the time confuse that outside world in a gushing way with the truth that exists for the supersensible worlds. When people are all the time using words that really only have a true value in the supersensible worlds, they are depriving themselves of the most important thing, which is that we learn to distinguish and not to mix up sense-perceptible and supersensible worlds, that we learn to use the words in their proper sense.
This really is a key point that speaks back to the use of the word spiritual and when to use it, when not, and why not. Certainly if one's going to use the word spiritual, if one isn't defining it right there and then, one certainly wants to be in the context of really exploring and unpacking what we're talking about. And this point that Steiner makes at the end there, which is in the context of Ahriman and the denial of the devil being the way that the devil takes full possession of us, has to do with something that I quoted earlier, or that Dale did, regarding when people ask questions about things they're not ready to hear the answers to, because they don't have the context. They haven't worked out the various questions and associations necessary to arrive at the answer. This is echoing something that came up yesterday on an affinity group, which is the idea that spiritual teachings, so-called, that are real, of course there's many that aren't, don't offer pat or fully formed answers. They present only half of the truth, and they can only really be understood if we have the other half, and we can meet those teachings or those interpretations with our own felt sense experience and possibly even cognitive or intellectual formulations, and thereby complete the teachings internally and make sense of them. I compared this to the original meaning of the word symbol, was an object broken in two halves, and one person kept one half and the other kept the other half, and it was a way for them to recognize each other when they met to complete a transaction or whatever other purposes it had. A symbol is half an object, or half a reality, and teachings are always symbolic. Anything that is language-based is symbolic. It's always half the picture, and it can only be completed with our own internal symbolism, which is not a teaching but an experience-based knowledge set. That gives the context to the words, the teachings, the ideas being presented and completes them. And the Ahrimanic way, according to Steiner, is to give a whole teaching, a whole experience that requires no work, no internal formulations or internal processes or synthesis or efforts on the part of the recipient. So they simply receive the download and are transformed by it, but in a way that is actually the opposite of wholeness. It causes increased fragmentation from our essence. This is similar to the idea that real learning is remembering, and so that teaching, real spiritual teaching, has to do with mnemonic devices that trigger memories in the body. And this can seem more fanciful than it is, in the sense of actual memories coming into consciousness, or somehow I remember I was Hitler in a past life kind of epic sort of associations there, as opposed to simply, I know what he's talking about because I've had this felt sense before, and now these words are making a more conscious sense of something that previously was more unconscious or more at a bodily level. Because there is a dimension to being which is non-material, which the body, although it's nested within and is a doorway to, does not have access to itself. We have to leave the flesh and blood and the nervous system behind to access it. But first of all, the body has to be a tuning fork that resonates with the pointers that we're observing, the signposts, the cues, and lets us know how to respond to them instinctively, intuitively, and finally, inspirationally. I hope that made some sense. But only you will know, because it will only make sense if it completes an unfinished formulation within your own consciousness.
In the material world, duality prevails. In the spiritual world, threefoldness. There are circumstances when it is by no means unimportant to understand that if someone says that there is white magic and black magic, this implies duality. But duality can have meaning only in the material world. Such a person, therefore, immediately shows that he has no notion of the fundamental laws of the spiritual world. For in the spiritual world, duality can never be a basic principle. True as it is that duality lies at the basis of the physical material world, it is also true that in the supersensible world, we never have to do with duality. Now the human being is related to the whole cosmos. As earthly man, he is a microcosm. And in order to understand certain matters, it is necessary to learn more about this relationship. We have heard that when man breaks through the veil of nature and penetrates into the world lying behind nature, he encounters Ahrimanic beings.
CERN again.
Beings intent upon destruction. In the world order, these beings are bitter enemies of man's earthly nature, so that if through weakness he allies himself with them, and this is possible, as I have indicated, he is allying himself with the enemies of man on earth. That is a fact. And a certain relationship existing between the human being and the cosmos does much to promote such an alliance.
Need to take a pause there, I think. Ahrimanic beings waiting on the other side of the veil of physical reality that some human beings make alliances with. That is a fact. And a certain relationship existing between a human being and the cosmos does much to promote such alliance.
That is a fact. These beings behind the veil of nature are highly intelligent. I have spoken of human intelligence, but these beings have their own kind of thinking and intelligence. They have feeling, although it is different from human feeling. They also have will, although it too is different from human will. They perform certain deeds which come to expression outwardly in manifestations of nature, but the essential substantiality of which lies behind the veil. Now there is a remarkable affinity between something in man and the highest faculties of these beings. I will make this clear in the following way. When man crosses the threshold of the spiritual world and approaches these beings, it may seem to him as if he were entering a veritable inferno, or whatever he conceives it to be. What matters is that he shall understand the experience aright. What will strike him most forcibly is the remarkable intelligence of these beings. For they are extraordinarily clever, extraordinarily wise. Their faculties of soul come to expression in this cleverness. But the soul forces, the higher forces of these beings, are all related to the forces of man's lower nature. sensuous urges in man are, in these beings, the very forces which strike one as so significant. Thus there is a relationship between the lowest forces of man and the highest forces of these spiritual beings.
The lowest forces in man and the highest forces in these spiritual or elementary beings.
That is why they strive to identify themselves with the lower forces in man. When a man enters this other world, instincts of destruction or hatred or the like arise in him, because these beings draw up what constitutes man's lower nature to their own higher nature, and with their higher forces work through man's lower forces. Nobody can ally himself with these beings without debasing his own nature, without greatly enhancing the strength of certain sensuous urges and impulses.
Painting, asked Crowley.
This is a fact of which special account must be taken, for it shows us unambiguously how we must picture our relation to the cosmos. In our own human nature there are lower urges and impulses, but these lower urges are forces which represent lower impulses only in us as human beings. These same urges are, in these spiritual beings, higher forces. But these beings are working all the time within us. They are always there within our nature. Our progress in spiritual science depends essentially upon our recognizing them, knowing that they are there. This enables us to say, we have our higher forces and we have our lower forces. And in addition, those forces which in us are lower forces, but in these spiritual beings are higher forces. This expands the duality of our higher and lower forces into a triad. We are already at the border of the threshold of the spiritual world, when instead of the duality of our higher and lower forces, we recognize the triad. The knowledge in its old form cannot be used. For if it were thus presented to men, it would bring about exactly what I have been speaking about. It would without any doubt arouse lower instincts in them. For example, there actually exists in the world an order which leads men to knowledge of these mysterious beings without any preparation. In all such men, instincts of destruction are aroused, so that this order is actually responsible for sending human beings with destructive instincts out into the world. In a passage in one of his writings, Nietzsche hinted at the existence of this order without knowing the actual circumstances. That is the one side which I have felt it essential to bring to your attention.
And now I, in my turn, after Rudy, have felt it essential to bring it to your attention. There is an order in the world. This is involved in bringing human beings into contact and alliance with beings of great intelligence, who thrive upon destruction, as we'll get to, and whose highest forces and intentions correspond with man's lowest or basest. Our spiritual progress depends on becoming acquainted with these beings, and recognizing once again, as was referenced to Ahriman and Lucifer, the way that they influence us and exist within us and in fact constitute our being to some extent. That alone turns an apparent polarity into a third thing, an apparent opposition into a potential collaboration, terrifying as that may be to contemplate. What Steiner's talking about, the key, I think the key thrust of this, the central thrust, has to do with turning a dyad into a triad. So we have the higher and the lower, and the correspondence between human beings' lower nature with the higher nature or power of these other beings, and how they ally themselves with us in such a way as to mine our own lower nature and inflame it, and presumably empower us thereby, but also increase their own power. The low corresponds with the high, and presumably the high also corresponds with the low. He doesn't get into that. But if our lower nature is their higher nature, then is their lower nature also our higher nature? Are they inversions of us? The meta question here is, I didn't really finish that point, I realised, but I'll get back to it. The meta question is it helpful to talk about these beings, or to think about them, or to acknowledge them even? Now, there's a the polarized viewpoint would be either they exist or they don't. If they don't exist, there's not really much harm in telling stories about them, although of course fiction can trigger our fight-flight mechanisms and all the rest of it. Fiction can be pernicious, so I'm not ruling that entirely out, but nonetheless, they don't exist, well, nothing to worry about really, just forget about it. If they do exist, we would want to know about them, particularly in the context that Stein is describing. We can't really avoid congress with them. Now, the third option is that they exist and they don't exist. In terms of mental apprehension, Steiner is talking about something that corresponds with a reality that we already have a felt sense experience of, and certainly are due to have one as we cross the threshold between the material and the spiritual, the temporal and, I suppose, the eternal. All well and good, but if we stay with the word, the language, the descriptions, then we may find ourselves wandering around in Chapel Perilous of David Icke land and speculating about dark satanic orders who are collaborating with reptilian shape-shifting entities, etc., etc. Certainly Steiner's model validates some of those interpretation systems, and there's a kind of thrill in that that I would say is to be avoided if possible, like an electric fence once you've recognized it's there. Well, maybe you go under it or over it, but you certainly don't want to just hold on to it. That's higher and lower, isn't it, again? Yeah, so entities, elemental beings, possibly even spiritual beings, that would seem to be the apotheosis of malevolence. As Stein will get into more, that their primary desire is that of destruction. Now, destruction itself is not a negative per se, because there are things that are better off destroyed, and there are also things that can only be made, reshaped, transformed, or redeemed through a force of destruction, the appliance of a destructive force. House renovation being the easy go-to example there, but there are countless others. So these beings have their place within existence, and they also have their place within us, within our bodies and our psyches. Getting to know them is unavoidable. Understanding them may not be possible. Anyway, ironically, and perhaps somewhat predictably, this does correspond quite closely with some of Whitley Strieber's writings about the visitors that they're always teaching him in forms of triad, that their teachings pertain to a, let's say, philosophical system that is a triad rather than the dyad. Now this, of course, is also the Holy Trinity of Christianity, specifically Catholicism, I think. And it may seem like a fairly familiar idea and not necessarily that revolutionary, but if we really try to think beyond polarities, good and evil, the obvious one philosophically, but hot and cold, up and down, in and out, young and old, wet and dry, etc., we'll find that we can't. There is no third thing conceptually from a language matrix between hot and cold or dead and alive. Our interpretation of reality is polarized. It depends on a polarity. When we're referring to the mind, I mean. And this relates to time and how we experience time also. The time is essentially a polarity too. It's future and past, because the present doesn't exist except that axis point between the two. It's a line with two ends, eternity being the bookends of that line. We've got the eternity of the before birth and the eternity of the after death, and our life is a linear progression from birth to death, that being the most experiential polarity, birth and death, or life and death. This is an error. That's all I have to say for now.
And if it's true, there is no cause to be afraid. Why are my sheets and smithereens under the bed that I made? I crash into a wall and break. I plan a trip, but never made it, as the sweat and the shade.
We know that already from the early Middle Ages onward, trichotomy, as it was called, the division of man into body, soul, and spirit, began to be a heresy in historical Christianity. As you know, a comparatively early council abolished the spirit and decreed that man was to be regarded as a being consisting only of body and soul. And since that time, this has become customary in the West. In the Middle Ages, it was a most terrible thing to speak of spirit, of a trichotomy. It was deemed the worst of all heresies, because spirit had been abolished and body and soul established as a duality. This is evidence of the endeavor to look even in number as applied to the human being, for what has significance only for this earthly world. The tendency is to keep man within a world that is in truth only Maya, because he stops short at the thinking, feeling, and willing, which are themselves of the same character. Attention is limited to those effects of the present incarnation, which last only through the first period between death and a new birth. What is elaborated in man's being in order, subsequently, to come forth in the next incarnation is left entirely out of account. I may perhaps indicate this diagrammatically in the following way, and there's a diagram. Here is the body, and here what lies behind it, which is not visible and could be perceived only by penetrating through the nerve endings. If atoms were not accepted as forming the basis of the world, but one were to go out of the body with vision, one would come to the realm where the beings of destruction seize hold of the whole man. And now, within this, I draw the life of soul unfolded by man in the physical world. Of the soul itself, the representatives of certain religious bodies say the human being dies, goes either to heaven or to hell, and we concern ourselves no more with him. According to certain representatives of religion, this is enough. What passes on to the next incarnation is not important. The aim is to conceal the fact that the spirit in man passes into the spiritual world and lives on until the next incarnation. It can be said that representatives of certain religious bodies are intent upon not allowing man to become aware of the yellow in his nature, upon preventing him from knowing anything of it. Here again, they are really obeying a certain sound instinct, but one which shows even more clearly than the instinct prompting the learned naturalists that in our time it has really lost its value. The efforts of the representatives of various religious communities all tend quite decisively in the direction of concealing the fact that there is a spiritual world to which belongs the inmost core of our being, which is destined to appear in repeated earth lives, and in the intervals between them to pass through an entirely spiritual form of existence. They try to conceal this by offering men the consolation that the life of soul, which comes to expression in thinking, feeling, and willing, is, after all, sufficiently immortal. In their actions and trend of thinking, these pastors of souls instinctively prevent men from coming into contact with certain beings. Man can never penetrate into the world of his true and innermost being without coming into contact with certain beings, just as, in the way described, he comes into contact with different beings if he desires or is actually able to break through the veil of nature. But the beings with whom he is related in this other world are of a luciferic order. If, as a result of certain teachings having been imparted to him without the requisite caution, a man comes into contact with certain destructive beings behind the veil of nature, he will become one who values nothing in the world, and it will soon be apparent that he takes actual pleasure in destruction, which need not necessarily be destruction of external things. Many men to whom this has happened have shown that they take pleasure in tormenting and oppressing other souls. These are the characteristics which come into evidence. But it can never be said that men who have such traits, owing to their alliance with Ahrimanic elementary beings, are invariably egotistic. They need not be, and indeed usually are not, egotists. They act out of an urge quite different from that of egotism. They act out of a lust for destruction, and they destroy without the slightest benefit accruing to themselves. The beings into whose sphere a man enters are essentially beings of destruction, and they tempt him, lure him to destroy. The other beings into whose sphere man comes, when he penetrates behind the veil of the life of soul, have a quite different character. They have no particular lust for destruction. In point of fact, what we know as destruction does not enter their ken.
Okay, it's time to take stock again. Steiner previously was referring to these two thresholds. One is the threshold of the afterlife, and the other is the threshold of before birth. One is leaving the mortal coil, leaving the physical, and entering into the supersensible realm, and the other is the reverse trajectory. However, he's also introducing this new wrinkle, which is that it's not a polarity, it's not a dichotomy, it's a trichotomy. So there's the realm of the physical matter, there's the realm of the soul, which I think corresponds with the psychic realms, psyche means soul, and then there's the realm of the spirit, which is the eternal. He's saying that on the threshold after death awaits Lucifer. Now, what I'm getting really is that Lucifer is on the threshold, not so much between the physical and the psychic or the soul dimension, but between the soul and the spiritual. Certainly this is what he's getting to anyway, with the beings that are not destructive, but are in fact creative, we'll get to that, are luciferic. So that corresponds with Lucifer waiting there on the threshold after we die. Previously, the destructive beings, they are manic, and they're on the threshold of entering into physical matter, also when we leave it. And so these beings have a lust for destruction. And religion, which is reduced a triad to a dyad, and historically, according to Steiner, has removed the element of spirit, which is the truly eternal, divine element of the human being, from the equation, thereby putting all the onus on the soul and creating a paradigm of heaven and hell, in which the soul endlessly relives all its good memories or all its bad memories, or bounces between the two, I don't know. And now I lost the thread of where I was going with that. Back to Ahriman, I believe, and the destructive beings on the threshold, somewhere like that. The lust for destruction, and how appealing to that in human beings feeds that desire to destroy them without there being anything in it for those humans. I don't know about the beings, but the humans who are possessed aramanically, let's say, and have a lust for destruction, they don't benefit thereby. It's a self-destructive path. I would guess, based on my own affiliation with or experience of these influences, in those formative years when I developed a lust for destruction through violent imagery, video nasties, and horror movies, that what's in it for the destruction lust is what he's referring to, that our basest nature gets raised up to the highest part of us, and we feel a visceral sense of power and gratification. So even the term lust infers some sort of gain in it, but presumably Stein is referring to, when he's saying that it's not ego driven, that there's really no positive gain short of the momentary thrill, the heady thrill of destruction itself. So even a person who killed himself might find gratification in committing the act, but clearly it would not lead to any kind of benefits. And it seems to me that this corresponds with nihilism quite closely, because a nihilist isn't seeking anything, probably, except momentary gratification and really relief from internal anguish. My brother, of course, is coming to mind, but so is the kind of Satanism that sort of populist kind of sort of Satanism, which is now intersecting with LGBT and identity politics and liberal progressivism. It's all about just the great indulgence, gratification of momentary desire. I think eventually it does lead to a destruction. It feeds an urge for destruction. That's my sense, and that's why body modifications and sex changes and so forth, gender changes, which is it, sex, gender, neither really, but anyway, are the symptoms of that thin end of that wedge, really. Well, it's fairly thick, actually. Anyway, so next up then is the Luciferic beings and how they influence us, and I can certainly relate to this equally well.
They have a veritable passion for creating, for bringing something into being, a tremendous urge for activity, for productivity. And they too have certain higher faculties, which are less closely related to our thinking than to our feeling, and especially to our will. We enter here into a sphere of beings preeminently related to our will, but curiously enough, to the noblest sides of our will. Thus, if we enter this world without knowing anything of what the initiate knows, namely that behind the world of nature and also behind the world of soul there is a spiritual world, when we fill our will with ideals, when we unfold noble, spiritualized will, this will becomes allied precisely with the lower attributes of these beings into whose sphere we have entered. There is a mysterious bond of attraction between the noble side of our will and the lower urges and desires of these beings.
So note the symmetry there. Lower natures correspond with the higher natures of the Ahrimanic, whereas here our higher aspirations, our higher will and desire correspond with the lower or basest urges or instincts of the Luciferic beings.
And now think of it. If a man's spiritual pastor gives him the consolation of immortality, laying stress on the dignity of the human soul, the majesty of the divine, and the like, it may happen that through some slight incitement, particularly if he was a noble character, he breaks through the membrane of his soul activity at some point and penetrates behind the secrets of his thinking, feeling, and willing. But he then comes into the region of these beings of will, and the consequence is that the idealistic side of his will actually begins to assume a sensuous character. And now, with this in mind, please read the descriptions given by certain mystics of either sex. If you read the biographies of these mystics, notice the sultry, voluptuous atmosphere which pervades them. The most sublime ideals assume a sensuous character. I would remind you of the rapture experienced by mystics in connection with their soul bride, in quotes, or, in quotes, soul bridegroom. In women mystics, the mystical union is like a sensuous union with the Savior, and in male mystics, like an actual bond with the bride of the soul, with the Virgin Mary. It is the endeavor of these beings of will to pour into man's thinking, into his ideals, what he otherwise knows as sensuousness. This is a hard saying. These beings into whose regions a man there enters strive, and from their own standpoint it is a justified striving, to pour their sensuous instincts into his idealized will.
Hey, little Johnny Goldenhands, are you listening? You hearing this?
And then the willing that goes out from the head which otherwise has a certain quality of cool detachment about it, is pervaded by a sultry, voluptuous experience of the spiritual world, which often seems to have the character of fevered mysticism. The representatives of the various religious bodies have an infinite dread of this, and their greatest fear of all is aroused by those among their believers who come forward as mystics.
C.F. John de Ruyter, circa 1987, in the Lutheran Church.
Verily, we have here Scylla and Charybdis. If we desire to pierce through the veil of nature, we come to Scylla, to the Ahrimanic beings who wish to endow us abundantly with destructive forces of intelligence. If we desire to pierce through the veil of the life of soul, we come to Charybdis, to the luciferic beings of will, who would fain pervade us with the fumes of spiritual ecstasy, spiritual rapture, spiritual instincts. Priestly orders intent upon the cultivation of the religious life were therefore in a certain sense right to take care that when mystics appeared among them, at least the shadow side of mysticism should not come to the fore. Hence, in a certain sense, they erected barriers against the entrance into the spiritual worlds. Just think how certain religious orders, I am speaking not of occult but of religious orders, were associated with manual work, with labor that allows delight in nature, delight in what lives in the world around, to arise in the soul.
CF Project Galicia, 2021.
Just think how such orders, if the right principles were understood, insisted upon outer manual work. Those who founded such orders said to themselves, quote, "The worst thing we could do would be to isolate men and allow the mystic life to develop in them as the outcome of inertia and idleness." Close quote. Read the monastic rules originating in better times and in the better orders, and you will everywhere see that full account was taken of what I have just mentioned, how mystic rapture and fevered ecstasy were counteracted by manual labor. And now you will also understand why Father Antonius caused Paul the Simpleton to work, even if it served no useful purpose. Had he allowed him to cultivate idleness for years, Paul the Simpleton would have become a sensuous, ecstatic mystic. We have, as you see, to do with duality, with objective occultism, which, if it is simply handed over to unprepared men, makes them destroyers.
Please know, all you occultists out there, you have just been owned.
And with subjective mysticism, which, if it is cultivated or suddenly appears in idealistic natures, makes men egotists. Egotists such as are to be met with in numbers of mystics who have developed merely a subtle form of egotism, a subtle mania for fostering their own souls.
My brother-in-law is somehow coming to mind there. But many spiritual seekers that we have known and tried very hard to love.
If you read the biographies of the mystics, you will often be appalled by the egotism they display. The region of Scylla is that of the spirits who serve Ahriman. We come into their sphere if we cultivate not egotism, but the will for destruction. If we cultivate the subjective mysticism connected with the luciferic spirits of will, into whose sphere we enter, then Charybdis approaches us from the other side. For these spirits do everything to foster egotism, so that our own inner nature forms the world for us. This is the duality in the material world: objective occultism, subjective mysticism. In both realms there may be aberrations. Fundamentally speaking, in what has been developing for centuries, there is present, on the one side, objective occultism, guarded in the secret societies and orders, but no longer effectively protected, owing to the insistent trend toward publicity. We have heard of the efforts that were made to find a way out of the dilemma. And on the other side, there is subjective mysticism. It follows from this that when we wanted to lay the foundations of spiritual science, it behooved us not to allow ourselves to be enticed either by Scylla or Charybdis, but to steer between them. It behooved us neither to cultivate the old traditional occultism nor the old traditional mysticism. And now you have a deeper conception of what gives our movement its direction. Both objective occultism and subjective mysticism in the old sense had to be avoided. Our spiritual science had to be of a character ensuring that Scylla as well as Charybdis are avoided. I have still to speak to you about the fundamental character which our spiritual science must bear in order that it may steer clear of both these dangers. But it obviously cannot be avoided that at the present time, out of mistaken notions, certain people come to us because some of them are looking for an old objective occultism, while others are hankering after old subjective mysticism. It is hardly likely that either the one type or the other will find among us what they are looking for. But they believe they find it by simply interpreting our teaching to suit their own liking. The form which our teaching must take, and what our attitude to it must be if our ship is to be steered between Scylla and Charybdis. Of this, I must speak again tomorrow. The end of Lecture 9.
Just to throw in some citations there for those who are sticklers for accuracy. The excerpt on meeting Lucifer after death came from How the Spiritual World Projects into Physical Existence, lectures from 1913. The complementary piece on trichotomy and the destructive beings is from Occult Movement, lectures 1915. And the following excerpts from on Lucifer and leaving the planet are from Understanding Society from 1919. What follows, we're back on Lucifer and Lucifer's influence and subtle internal realms, but also the alleged Lucifer incarnation, and how everything that we recognize now as paganism, pagan primal wisdom, is sourced in Lucifer's influence, including Lucifer's actual incarnation, I believe, about 1,000 years before old J.C. walked the earth, both of him, according to Steiner. So that's pretty interesting, because we know that Jesus Christ was extremely influential. Even though he never wrote a word, we have a whole Christian culture now that's worldwide and has shaped not just the course of history, but the evolution of human consciousness. Lucifer, on the other hand, his influence has been much more occult. But if Steiner's right and there was a physical incarnation, I'd be very interested in the life of that Lucifer dude when he walked the earth, in terms of whether his influence, how direct or indirect it was, for inspiring the pagan religions, forms of worship that are now largely associated with or complementary with occultism. Anyway, that's purely speculative. Let's hear what Rudy has to say.
Now, we also know that a Lucifer individuality himself incarnated in Asia at a particular point in pre-Christian times and was the originating source of pagan Ur wisdom, in particular of the kind that we can still discern by studying historical facts. In what we might call the play of humanity's evolution, the Luciferic beings, however, were always present. Now, I want to ask you very seriously, although I'm aware how little notice is taken, really, of such pleas, not to be smug or Philistine when thinking of the being of Lucifer. A great many of those who feel part of the anthroposophic movement tend to repudiate Lucifer. I have often spoken of this tendency. They say, quote, "That's Luciferic, for heaven's sake. Have nothing to do with it," close quote. But all these things have to be viewed and judged from the most varied angles. We must recognize and squarely acknowledge that, in fact, all the primordial pagan wisdom of humanity arose from a Luciferic source. But we also need to study how this took place. And the further back we go in humanity's evolution, the more we find certain people whose reincarnations had equipped them, made them mature enough, to acquaint themselves with the wisdoms possessed by Luciferic beings. We speak, for instance, of the 7 holy rishis in India. Those initiated into these things in India always drew on the wisdom of the 7 holy rishis when they uttered their wisdom, knowing that the true teachers of the rishis were Luciferic beings. What the Luciferic beings brought with them into earth evolution, with which, as I said, they interwove themselves, was first and foremost always the whole thought world, the intellectual world of thought, the rational world in the best sense, the world of wisdom pervading human culture. If we go back to the origins of humanity, we always find the sources of this pagan wisdom in Luciferic beings. We can ask how such a thing can be possible.
Well, funny enough, I was just about to ask that, but not the way that Rudy means it. I was going to ask, well, how is it possible that he knows this? Or rather, how is it possible for us to know what he's talking about if he's not going to refer to any specific Luciferic individuals? Who are these unnamed, unidentified sources of pagan wisdom that he calls Luciferic beings?
And here we must be quite clear that the human being would have remained childlike without receiving continual instruction through the mysteries from all kinds of Luciferic beings. The essential thing is that those who needed the knowledge, the wisdom required for the education and development of humanity, this inherited primordial wisdom, were not shy, like a modern Philistine, of receiving this wisdom from the Luciferic element. But they accepted everything a person must incur if he receives such instruction from the spheres of spirit from Luciferic beings. Above all, the human being had to take on, we might call it an obligation, although such words, of course, can never precisely express what is meant, this Luciferic wisdom, which is, of course, cosmic wisdom, parenthesis, to be used as good wisdom in the service of earth evolution, close parenthesis. The difference between good wisdom and Luciferic wisdom consists in the fact that the good wisdom is in other hands, while Luciferic wisdom, whose content is the same, is in Luciferic hands. The content is entirely the same. That is the important thing.
Well, a hammer in one man's hands is a weapon, and another man's hands is a tool of building a shelter. Now, what he's talking about there occurs to me, well, Dale in our conversation referred to this, that Lucifer is wisdom without love, Christ is love and wisdom combined, and that as far as I can pick up so far, the triad of Ahriman, Lucifer and Christ, corresponds with thinking, willing and feeling. Although I haven't heard Steiner actually say that, attribute feeling to the Christ principle, but I was listening to The Mystery of Golgotha recently, and well, there's a lot to talk about there, but the central thing is how Christ is the mediating influence that and the recurring incidents of Golgotha at the subtler realms before it became a physical thing that introduces the element of selflessness into human beings' faculties of perception, cognition and articulation. So starting with the senses, seeing and hearing and so on, that these are bestowed by Lucifer, but in their pure form they are deranging and insultive, so that the color blue we would experience as sucking the energy out of our eyes, whereas the color red we would experience it as piercing our eyes or penetrating them in a painful way. And then with the senses of the life force energy, such as smelling, like a pleasant smell, would drive us wild with irresistible desire to find it and consume it, and an unpleasant one would cause us to run in the opposite direction. We would have no control over our responses. And Christ introduces this element of moderation, which relates to selflessness, as in our senses. And this also then extends to consciousness and thought itself. Our senses are not driven by self-will. Our eyes don't react to what they see because they're selfless. But what I'm wondering about now, and whether this is related or not, or how it's related, I should say, the element of feeling that turns Lucifer's wisdom, Lucifer's hammer, into a tool for building rather than a weapon of destruction, has to do with what I talked about on the last Reading Rudy podcast, the awareness of existing in a living feeling element of consciousness, whereby everything we do, or everything we think, or even when we put our attention or our senses onto anything in our environment, we impact it. It is impacted by us. And so this is the element of feeling. Thinking, it has to do with interpreting and analyzing, hence I think is Ahrimanic, because that's breaking things down. It seems to be inherently destructive, which isn't to say evil. Will has to do with action, it has to do with desire as well. Whereas feeling has to do with responding, how we respond internally to things, and to do with empathy and a sense of sensitivity to everything in our environment, inner and outer. So I think that this has to do with how the Luciferian wisdom is potentially destructive if it becomes well, particularly if it's hooked into our thinking, that then it just becomes fuel for our will without the feeling element of Christ that moderates our relationship to the wisdom and our appliance of it. It's essentially, it's how it's applied that makes the difference. And I suppose in my own life, I think that because I was so heavily identified with Lucifer, while at the same time being quite Aramaic and being very thinking based, having a very thinking based relationship with knowledge, but also will based, it spired me into willful action and into desire and into the egotism he talks about and the productivity and the creativity and all of those things that he's identifying as Luciferian. That at a certain point, my Icarus period, I became burnt out by my own lack of compassion, my lack of feeling around my relationship with an appliance of this knowledge. And so I had to come down to earth and I had to, in a certain sense, reject the knowledge, reject the wisdom, as if it was inherently false, because how else was I going to do it? If I'd continued to believe that it was all true and solid and good, without recognizing that the essence was the medium and not the message, then I wouldn't have been able to see the error. First of all, I had to let go of the knowledge base and the beliefs that had formed around it. And I think that's how it is that I'm returning to it now in this new way, hopefully with a more moderate and more Christ-like way of handling it. You don't give kids to matches. You don't give matches to kids, to children, unless you want to teach them about fire in the most painful and destructive way. But once they're grown into adults, that experience may serve them in any way. Either way, they're ready to handle fire.
It is not true to say that there is a wisdom that one can neatly pocket in the inner chamber of the soul to become a good person by means of it. Wisdom is whole and entire in the world. And the difference is only that it can, for instance, be in the hands of wise people who handle it well, or in the hands of Angeloi, Archangeloi, and so forth, or in the hands of Lucifer. In ancient times, wisdom needed for humanity's progress could not be gained anywhere else, and so the initiates of those days had to receive it from Luciferic hands, and had to undertake not to succumb to the other aspirations of these Luciferic beings. It was Lucifer's intention to pass wisdom to humanity in order to ensure that instead of undertaking the path of earthly evolution, human beings would pass through evolution in a super-earthly sphere, in a sphere removed from the earth. And so, if I were to draw this schematically, I would say that if this is the surface of the earth here, there's a drawing, the human being ought to take this path when he arrives on earth at this point. The Luciferic beings instill their wisdom into the human being, but by doing so, they seek to divert him from the earth, so that he does not pass through earth evolution. Lucifer wants to leave the earth to its fate, unpopulated by humankind. He wants to win over humanity to a distinct realm alien to the Christ realm.
So there we have the correlation between Lucifer's temptation, the gift of the imagination, you shall be as gods, etc., and as mapped in Prisoner Infinity, the technocratic drive to leave the planet, to colonize space, and its softer, more digitized equivalent with transhumanist, and the more subtler, more ancient, more overarching thrust towards disembodiment. The storming of heaven, it seems to me it's the fallback position for Icarus when he realizes he can't storm heaven, which presumably Lucifer has figured out by now if he didn't know it from the start, which is to create a false heaven, which is a hell in which Lucifer can rule. And this requires disconnecting from the earth and from the body, because the earth and the body, by the same token that are the only route to the supersensible realms, the elementary realms, the eternal spiritual realms, not making all those synonymous, but anyway, the subtler realms, including all the way into the realms of eternity, where God is the source of all goodness, the body being the only way, and the senses and the internal organs, etc., and the nervous system being the only way to navigate the labyrinth of Ahrimanic Luciferian deception that we're snared in and make it through. By the same token, in order to escape, the body is our conscience. The body lets us know when we're off course, off track, when we're distorting, when we're debasing, when we're misrepresenting reality, and when we're revolting against reality. And therefore, the Luciferic bid to apply the wisdom without love, without compassion, without feeling, requires a disconnection from the body, which at a macrocosmic level is an attempt to lure humanity off course, off track from its material, earth-based evolutionary trajectory, and into these extraterrestrial realms that Lucifer himself presumably has created, or is using our energy and awareness to create. Now all this is very metaphysical, metaphorical, like a fable, but we are seeing it and experiencing it, and all wrapped up in the midst of it at a very tangible and, in fact, inescapable socio-cultural and political reality. It's happening before our eyes. And while this is where Steiner potentially is useful, and people, as long as we're going to continue to look at the world and analyze the world and try and understand what's going on, which in a certain sense I don't recommend it, even though I spent many years doing it. I certainly don't recommend it as a means to finally come to grips with the nature of the world, because one can't fully understand the nature of anything. One can only experience it. But for my own self on this trajectory of mapping hell, it would seem as though my means of existing is gradually and through precise steps along the spectrum or the continuum between the socio-political and the cultural, to the psychological, through the psychological, and into the metaphysical, and into the spiritual, finally. And Steiner would seem to be, currently at least, the ferryman to cross that river of forgetting.
The wise initiates of ancient times, who received the primordial wisdom from Lucifer's hands, therefore had to undertake not to submit to Lucifer, but receiving his wisdom, to use it in the service of Earth's evolution. And this is largely what was also accomplished in the mysteries of pre-Christian times. And if you ask what humanity really received in these pre-Christian mysteries, through the influence of the Luciferic beings who first, thus still in the post-Atlantean period, inspired certain individuals, the Indian rishis, and then also sent their grand ambassador to the earth, as I indicated, you find that it is everything which human beings have developed as capacities of speech and thinking. Speaking and thinking, you see, are originally very much Luciferic in nature, except that the wise initiates of primordial times were able to inveigle these arts away from Lucifer. If you wish to flee Lucifer, you'll have to resolve to be silent in future and to refrain from thinking. These things belong to the initiation science that humanity must gradually learn. Even though centuries of Philistine education in the civilized world make people draw back fearfully from such truths. For a very long time, people have been indoctrinated with this caricature of Lucifer and Ahriman, identical with the medieval concept of the devil. They have been allowed to grow up in an atmosphere of Philistinism, so that still today they regard these wisdoms only with horror, though they are intimately connected with humanity's evolution. You see, it is awfully pleasant for people to think they are keeping themselves safe from the devil and dedicating themselves to Christ in childlike simplicity. Then they think they will be blessed and their soul will be saved. But the subterranean depths of human life are not so straightforward.
Another classically Steiner-esque understatement.
And it is very important for the future of human evolution that these things we have been speaking of now should not be kept from people. It is important to know that the art of speech and the art of thinking were only able to enter this earthly evolution because humankind received them through the mediation of Lucifer. You can still detect the Luciferic element in your thinking today. Ahriman has, meanwhile, long since seized hold of the languages that adapted and diversified according to different regions. Ahriman caused this differentiation, so that original unified language was brought down into diverse earthly language. Whereas Lucifer always has a tendency to unite and create uniformity, the Ahrimanic principle is pervaded by the tendency for differentiation. What would thinking be like if it were not Luciferic? Well, if thinking were not Luciferic, most people in the world would think like a figure whose thinking was least Luciferic of all, Goethe. Goethe is one of those whose thinking was least Luciferic, and who, in certain respects, was intent on looking the Luciferic power squarely in the face. But this necessitates adhering as far as possible to specific tangible details. The moment you generalize, standardize, and unify, you are approaching Luciferic thinking. You would only be less susceptible to Luciferic thinking if you were to regard every person, every single animal, every separate plant, each different stone on its own distinct terms. Focusing your thinking only on each distinct object, rather than comprehending them in terms of species and collective types, not generalizing in any way, not unifying them in general concepts. But If you were to begin doing so already as a child, you'd be kept down in the nursery class. So that isn't possible. Instead, you have to recognize that generalized thinking, which was especially current in pagan peoples, will gradually fade altogether. People are now no longer predisposed to make much use of such unifying simplification on the earth. And this is due to the fact that our God-created human nature has gradually developed a greater affinity with the earth, with earthly things, as we evolved. Through this developing affinity with the earth, we are now already, by our very nature, less related to the Luciferic element that seeks to divert us away from the earth. But it would be a poor outlook if human beings were only to relinquish the Luciferic element without anything else replacing it. It would be very bad indeed, for it would mean that they would come to identify entirely with the earth, that is, with the particular territory or region where they are born. Each culture would become entirely differentiated and distinct. We can see this tendency already emerging, developing especially since the beginning of the 19th century. But today, still more since the catastrophic World War, we see an increasing tendency to fragment into ever smaller and smaller groups. Nationalism, national chauvinism, is increasingly becoming prominent. People dividing into ever smaller and smaller groups, until at last such a group could consist of only a single individual. Then, perhaps this individual might go on dividing into a left and a right side and end up in a war with himself, the right side battling with the left.
Well, this brings to mind something I've commented recently about the rights of the body, seeing as we're in a phase in culture in which it's being advocated to alter the body and even to amputate parts of the body in order to reify the identity and make the individual sovereign within its own conceptual kingdom, which is both Luciferian and Ahrimanic, then why not keep going and consider the different organs? What kind of rights do they have if they're going to be removed or chopped off or considered not part of the system or somehow foreign to the desire of the conscious ego? Seems as though what Stein is predicting there is an unholy alliance between Lucifer and Ahriman, where they seem to be more at war than allied, perhaps because they don't have the reconciling influence, the vesica piscis, between them of Christ. I don't know, I'm just guessing and free associating. But this pendulum between generalization and fragmentation seems to be swinging ever faster. And it's weird how they're essentially, these opposites are complementary, but not in a productive or a benevolent way. Well, perhaps in the larger context, eventually we will see that. But currently, it appears to be more like a kind of vicious circle that is spinning faster and faster between the reification of the individual and the resulting fragmentation or the increased fragmentation that causes, and the deification of the collective and the overgeneralization and the homogenization that results in. And ditto with our relationship to our bodies and to the earth. We're either too stuck and too over-identified with materiality, and so sitting ducks for Ahriman to possess us, or we're fleeing from them and trying to transcend falsely into some conceptual realm, and so we become food for Lucifer.
Human evolution is already showing much potential for this, and a counterbalance is needed. We can only counter this tendency with a new wisdom, rather like the primordial wisdom that imbued pagan culture, but now developing through and accomplished by free human will, a new wisdom that can inform earthly culture. This new wisdom must again be initiation wisdom, and must exceed all that can only be encompassed in isolated fashion in each separate individual. And here, we arrive at something that must not be withheld from people today, if, as they develop into the future, they were to do nothing to achieve a new wisdom for themselves. Things would occur in the subconscious depths of human nature, which I have to some degree already described to you, that is, the Ahrimanization of all human culture. The culture of humanity would be Ahrimanized, and it would then prove easy for this incarnated Ahriman of whom I spoke to pervade earthly culture with his own being. And for this reason, we must work to hinder all the currents that support and promote Ahrimanic culture. And what would Ahriman bring? Employing the most grandiose arts, Ahriman would bring to the human being all that we understand here as clairvoyant knowledge, which so far, otherwise, has only been gained by the greatest effort and exertion. Just imagine how infinitely comforting this would be. People would not have to do anything themselves. They could go on living their materialistic lives, could eat and drink, or at least could eat as much as remains after the catastrophic war, and would not need to concern themselves with any spiritual striving or mental exertion. The Ahrimanic streams would take their pleasant course. When, at the due moment, Ahriman is incarnated in the Western world, he would found a great secret school where the most grandiose arts of magic would be practiced, and from here all humanity would be showered with everything that can otherwise only be gained through great exertion.
Somebody somewhere make a comparison between the Waldorf schools and the Harry Potter schools. I hope it wasn't me.
It would be Philistine to think that Ahriman, when he comes, will be a kind of mischief maker who plays all kinds of tricks on human beings. No, indeed. All those comfort lovers who reject spiritual science today would succumb to his magic. For through his magic arts, he would be able to turn large numbers of people into clairvoyants. But these great clairvoyant gifts would be entirely diverse. What one person sees will be different from what another person does. Confusion would reign. And though people received a foundation of clairvoyant wisdom, they would inevitably fall into conflict through the very different nature of their perceptions. But ultimately, people would be very content with their visions, since each person would be able to see into the world of spirit. And this in turn would mean that all earthly culture would fall prey to Ahriman.
Alright, well, that's where I will end this exegesis of Rudolf Steiner. Once again, as last time, I'm walking it off. Had a long walk, it's been very windy, and I thought I'd do a last minute meta summation, but I can't remember what I was going to talk about. It had to do with Dave Oshana and the light and the dark, and his focus on goodness currently, and how I seem to be, while in my life, definitely focusing more and more on nature, connecting to the earth, ordinary, everyday endeavors, projects that are enhancing my sense of being in the flow of goodness, and as Rudy puts it, no one can get out of God, being on the inside of God and letting go and letting myself be digested and assimilated by the great infinite, a bit tautological that. My focus with the podcast is back into the occult, the obscure, the dark, particularly, of course, no surprise to anyone perhaps, I'm drawn to the Lucifer material and this very dark material, Aramaic, about the destructive beings and so on and so forth. And so of course it causes me to wonder if there's a complementary yin-yang sort of balance there between what Dave's focusing on and what I'm focusing on. Let's see. Well, the other thing was this realization about symbols and spiritual teachings always just being half of the whole object, the hyperdimensional object, truth, wisdom, knowledge, that's particularly observable with Dave. My experience is that he's waiting to be met with the other half. If you don't meet the other half, where you just get a kind of half-baked sandwich. And of course he's working with a large group of 30 people on Sunday, and it's not enough. There has to be something of a consensus, maybe it's the lowest common denominator, hopefully it's the highest common denominator, but even so, it's the ratio, it's the mean, the average of what he's being met with, and it's just not enough for me. That format isn't enough, the sit passively in a group of people and listen to the guru speaking platitudes. At the best of the times, it's still not quite enough, I'd say, although I enjoy it. But even there, I want to collaborate by writing about it and sharing it or building on it or extrapolating and so on and so forth. And, well, I just feel I have my own work cut out. So the only reason to attend Dave events currently is to support him financially, which is reasonable, and to know what's going on so I can be on the same page with other participants at the AGs, particularly the men's group, which are good reasons, and so I don't know what I'll do, but I'm aware that I have people that I reach and I'm connecting to who are not drawn to Dave and perhaps never will be, and that I'm providing something specific that to them is nourishing, meaty, substantial, that Dave either can't or won't provide, and that is superficially, ostensibly, a darker portion of the sandwich. That's the concealed part.